Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. What happens in your brain? Happy Halloween, by the way. What happens in your brain, though, when you experience fear or you get a real good fright? And how has our understanding of the way our body experiences fear changed over time? Well, to mark Halloween, we'll want to explore these and other questions about the nature of fear with Dr. Daniel Trunell. He's a professor of neurology and brain sciences at the University of Iowa. Also, Kelsey Spaulding, a fifth-year doctoral candidate in clinical psychology at the UI, studies fear generalization. Dr. Trunell and Kelsey Spaulding, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you, Ben. Glad to be here. Happy Halloween. I'm dressed as a brain scientist here, as you can see.
Ian Miller is with us as well. He's in our Des Moines studio, owner and operator of Slaughterhouse. Is it The Slaughterhouse or just Slaughterhouse, Ian?
Hi, Ben. Happy Halloween. It is The Slaughterhouse.
The Slaughterhouse. And this is a haunted house, or how do you like to describe it?
We are the new premier haunted attraction in central Iowa.
Okay, haunted attraction. There we go. Let's start out with your haunted attraction. And when people pay, how much do they pay, by the way?
Our general admission cost is $20. That means you got to stand in a line.
Wow, I better get frightened. All right. What do I get for my $20? What happens to me?
So we've got an average of 20-minute experience inside the attraction, but it really starts when you enter the gates. So you come through the gates, you purchase your ticket, and you stand in the queue where several line actors are gathered around, and they perform all sorts of antics, which get you in the spirit and prepare your mind for the battle within the attraction.
Okay, once you get in, what I know, without giving it away, of course, the essence of fright is to be surprised by something truly awful. But what can you tell us about what you're particularly proud of this year in reaching your goal of giving patrons a real fright?
So obviously, the audience's perspective changes over time, and in our modern world, most people are desensitized to a great degree. So while it is important to create a great startle in the dark and show the things that people would expect to horrify them, it's also, and more critical in my mind, to create an extremely immersive environment that encapsulates, you know, the lead up to that moment of fear. So we do our best to create an extremely immersive atmosphere leading up to each startle.
You want people to have really jangly nerves in a short amount of time. You do this with what? Sounds as well, I bet.
Everything from sound to smell, touch.
Are there things touching me when I go in?
Props sometimes will touch the patrons. Our actors are not allowed to. However, our actors do handle props from time to time as well. So
Okay. And you've been doing this how many years?
This was actually the fifth season of operation for the Slaughterhouse. We did go dark, no pun intended, for 3 years between 2013 and our new rebirthing year this year.
Okay. Before we get to our fear scientists here, I imagine one of the worries or the concerns that you have is you have to walk a line. You have to be safe, but you have to give people the feeling they're not safe. How do you do that?
It's a conversation that we have ongoing throughout the season and leading up to the season. It's a difficult line to walk. I mean, we've joked about actually putting a sign on the front of our ticket trailer that says hashtag trigger warning, because the entire place is one in this in this modern day and age.
Do you have a warnings when you go in? Because there are people, you know, you would think they would know this themselves. If you have a heart condition, you don't go into one of these places, right? But do you have any specific language that is a disclaimer or?
We do. It's everywhere. It's on the site. It's on the back of the ticket. It's on several placards when you walk up to the attraction and actually inside the beginning of the attraction.
And it says?
It says it has a warning about the fact that we use theatrical lighting, strobes, fog, things of that matter. We also warn them against any loose articles and, of course, any property that they might be holding. We warn against any use of drugs and alcohol before entering. We warn against, of course, carrying any kind of weapons or anything of that nature.
Mm-hmm. What's the most terrified you've seen one of your patrons? Describe that person.
For those of you that don't believe in the paranormal, levitation is a very possible effect. I've seen individuals basically levitate through a room. They're so scared they bounce off the wall like a pinball. But some of the other effects that happen are vomiting, wetting of pants, and defecation.
Wow. And does that tell you you've reached your goal or not reached your goal?
We do have a leather belt that we notch.
Okay. Join our conversation, Ian Miller, owner and operator of the Slaughterhouse in Des Moines, a haunted attraction, open, of course, this time of year. Dr. Daniel Trunell, a neuropsychologist with us, along with graduate student Kelsey Spaulding, who does work in fear science. Dr. Trunell, so from what we gather of this description of the slaughterhouse in Des Moines, what is happening in terms of brain science, people going to the slaughterhouse from a mild scare to what he just described, where I'm sure people did not mean to pay for that result?
Yeah, it was a $20 they're paying for that result.
We do offer a diaper at the trailer if they need.
Yeah, so fear is a very basic emotion that's, you know, that's hardwired into us right from the start. It's an extremely important emotion for survival. And we implement that emotion in our bodies and in our brains using a lot of the basic primitive parts of the brain that are set up to deal with, you know, survival and to deal with the appropriate responses to fearful stimuli. Sudden loud noises, things like the visual cliff or the appearance that you're about to fall off of the edge of something are very basic responses that occur in very young children in the first year of life. And then fear of things like snakes and spiders are also very basic fears that set in early in development.
Mm-hmm. He spoke about the tactile feeling, things that will touch you. Here too. That is something that will set people off. You're in the dark and something brushes against you.
Mm-hmm.
It's all hooked into a system that can react how quickly to a stimulus?
Well, within milliseconds. That system is multifaceted. So you have nervous signals that can occur in milliseconds on the scale of milliseconds, and also hormonal signals that take a little longer but can provide a more widespread, you know, multifaceted response throughout your body. And what Ian has taken advantage of, and you know, Halloween tends to be about in some ways, is the fact that there's overlap in how those nervous impulses and hormones trigger and activate different parts of our brain. Overlap meaning you get some activation of systems that have a certain kind of pleasure and reward associated with them. You know, why do people go to scary movies? Why do people go to Ian's place and pay money to go in there and get scared? It activates, you know, parts of our brain that there's a reward value associated with that.
A reward not during it, but after, that you've, what the sense, I've survived this mortal threat?
Yeah, I think a little bit during and after. People seek out scary situations deliberately and, you know, pay money for movies and money for Ian's whorehouse.
Right. Kelsey Spaulding, get in here as a doctoral candidate studying fear at the University of Iowa in clinical psychology. relate your work perhaps to Ian's work there in giving people a thrill, a fright. What are you doing specifically?
So I'm interested in fear generalization. So when we learn to be afraid of something, this often generalizes to things that remind us of the initial fearful event. So you can think of a soldier goes to war, he comes back, and now he might experience fear in the space of the sound of a firework or the sound of a car backfiring, something that reminds them of the fearful event.
Right.
So this process happens naturally in everyone, but it's exaggerated in fear disorders. But in a haunted house type of situation, you could use things that remind us of these fearful experiences to trigger the same kind of response and play on fear generalization in that way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Since you're here, Kelsey, let me first start with Ian. Do you notice a difference in fear response at the slaughterhouse, Ian, a gender difference, male, female, in the degree to which they show fear, how they show fear?
Typically, the biggest difference you see is that men will typically show less fear on the onset, but as they get into the attraction and into the darker spaces, a lot of the times they respond a lot more than a female will.
Their mask drops, so to speak.
Yeah, it does in the dark. And along the same lines about the triggers of fear and that kind of sadomasochistic desire of the human, I think that, you know, we're all connected by one extremely impactful event in our lives, childbirth itself. And I think that first very traumatic, as beautiful as it is as well, of course, that really traumatic, bloody event, you know, that's our first connection to our breathing experience in life. And I think that you know, we want to reconnect with that from time to time. I think it's part of the reason why there is a pleasure in being scared.
Kelsey Spaulding, as a female brain scientist, do you keep up on the literature about the differences in fear between the genders?
So we know that there's a difference in between the genders and who's diagnosed with having a fear-related disorder or an anxiety disorder. And they tend to occur much more frequently in women. So often 2-to-1, actually, in women.
Mm.
And so
thoughts on why that is?
Well, it's thought that there is likely a biological component to why this would happen more frequently in women. But we also have to take into account that, as Ian was mentioning, women sometimes express fear and anxiety more differently. So it's also possible that it's reported more frequently in women than in men. But with that sort of a discrepancy, it's likely there's also a biological component as well.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Trinnell, let's say I'm going to go to Ian's slaughterhouse. It's a first date. I'm a young guy. It's a first date. Bad first date. You'd say, don't do it. You say, right, Ian?
Well, it depends.
Let's say I'm really concerned about becoming too frightened and, could lead to whatever, we know. Is there any way beforehand for me to inoculate myself, so to speak, to think certain thoughts, to get in a certain frame of mind so that when I walk in and Ian does his best for my $20, I can still have respect when I walk out?
Yeah, so I guess I can give the very extreme version of the preparation for that, Ben, which would be to go into the Department of Neurosurgery at the University of Iowa Clinics and ask them to perform a bilateral amygdalectomy and remove your amygdala on both sides. You have a left one and a right one.
That's more than $20.
That's more than $20, and it's not reversible, and so that it's not something everybody would do. But that would inoculate you extremely well, and we have lots of good science to support that. In fact, a field experiment on exactly this experiment. So.
Right, right. Talk a little bit more about that, because we talked on an earlier program. You analyzed over years, studied her for decades, a woman who actually felt no fear due to damage to her amygdala?
Correct. Yeah, exactly. And we did several years ago with a former student of mine, Justin Feinstein, who led this experiment. We took her through a haunted house. Ian may know of this. It's a place in Louisville that's reputed as the, you know, scariest one in the country or something to that effect, and led her through that place. And she went through that with no fear and leading the troops and going down dark hallway after dark hallway and being touched by monsters and et cetera, with no fear.
And you had sensors on her. You could see that it wasn't just an act. her system was not responding as most people's do.
Correct. Yeah, mm-hmm. Quite the contrary. She enjoyed the experience and was wow. was leading the way. Yeah, so
maybe
so,
you'll get her coming in, Ian.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll do our best.
But there was, if I'm recalling your research with her, there was one thing that you could create fear in her with, and it's been mentioned already, breathing, right? You mentioned this, Ian, being born and gasping for air. Wasn't that what tripped her?
Well, I'm not sure Ian was quite referring to that, but...
No, what you're referring to in your research.
Yeah,
it was the breathing. That was something that...
In the research, so what we discovered, Ben, is that that breathing a high concentration of carbon dioxide, so 35%, which is about 850 times what's normally in the air, it causes the sense of strangulation or suffocation. And in this patient, our expectation going into this was that she would not have a fear response because we hadn't been able to scare her with anything, snakes, spiders, the haunted house, anything, for 20 years of trying. In this experiment, to our amazement, she actually panicked, had an exaggerated fear response, and panicked and literally sort of came unglued in the situation. And later, it became, as we tested this out in our experiments, it became apparent that the key difference was this stimulus is interoceptive, or coming through the body as opposed to coming from the outside world. And that fundamental difference is what led to a different response and used a pathway that bypasses the amygdala to activate her entire fear response.
Mm-hmm. We know our society has become coarser in many ways over the last few years, and also we have more and more horrific films. It seems we're getting desensitized here. You've been running, Ian, your first time out with the Slaughterhouse was in 2010. In that short time, in those 7 years, have you noticed that people are harder to scare? Are they more desensitized than they were when you started?
I have to believe that they are, just from the level of graphics that are now created and are marketed. It's really hard to tell, though, because we do see thousands and thousands of patrons on a yearly basis. So it really comes down to viewing and witnessing the individual effects of the patrons. And we just do our best to make sure that every person, you know, gets their three startles before they mm-hmm. before they leave the
okay.
exit.
I could add a comment to that,
yeah.
Ben, if you want.
Yeah,
I think there's, I would agree with Ian, and I think there's been kind of a change in the kinds of stimuli that are required to trigger fear responses in people.
For instance?
Well, you know, we don't encounter bears, I mean, on a regular basis, and even spiders and snakes, which are so sort of hardwired. I mean, we don't encounter things like that nearly as much as, you know, our 100 years ago ancestors. A lot of the things that trigger fear now are social related and related to being in crowded spaces with a lot of other people, and have to do a lot with the density of people and the crowding in urban areas. And a lot of the phobias that we deal with as clinical psychologists are related much more to that than to, you know, fear of basic things like spiders and snakes and bears.
Mm-hmm. Kelsey Spaulding, your thoughts on how fear, perhaps desensitizing the society has been to our fears?
Yeah, I think I would agree with what Dr. Trunnell was saying in terms of you kind of see a shift in what people are coming in for and what they're reporting fears of.
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of see that with prevalence rates, that when you look at people reporting social phobia or social anxiety, that's really high. It's right up there next to specific phobias mm-hmm. like spiders and snakes and things like that.
You know, if we took you, Kelsey, or you, Dr. Trunnell, or you, Ian, and we took you, well, if we were in the 30s, I don't know, when did the original Frankenstein come out in the cinema with Boris Karloff, you know?
Yeah.
I have spoken with an older person, and they said, you know, when that came out, that was terrifying. But we see it. Younger eyes see it. Our eyes, any eyes almost, see it, and they think, silly.
Right.
Anything but frightening, right? So then, I don't know. That's desensitization, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, uh-huh. there's been a lot of that, and I think Ian, I mean, the challenge for somebody like Ian is to keep those places up to up to speed and with the times in terms of trying to scare. I wouldn't want to try to scare a teenager today with, I mean, what would you do to them?
Ian, are they harder to scare than older folk?
No, if you create the right environment and the correct lead up, then you can startle anyone. While we are, like, scaring is the word, but really what we're focused on is the startle. Many people will give in to their fear, and they will allow themselves to be immersed and be under that veil of, the attraction itself. They'll let go, but it's really the individuals that won't that we focus on. So it's about creating those startle effects. It's about those really loud noises and bright lights in the darkest spaces in between the scenic environments, which are created just to immerse and completely encapsulate the mind of those that are both there for the visual aesthetics, those that don't really have that amygdala response, and those that are there to be completely immersed and maybe leave with a change of pants in mind.
A couple of quick questions before we leave for today. I imagine you have people on both ends of the spectrum, people who go through multiple times, Ian, right?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, well, okay. The other end of this, and I want a truthful answer here, even though it's Halloween. How many people, what percentage would you say walk out and say, I will never, ever in my life do that ever again or anything like it?
10%.
10%. Okay. Yep. I was saying 5 or 10. I was thinking to myself that was about it. Okay. Very good. Is there a future? Ian, do you see a time when we're so desensitized that you just throw up your hands and you say, can't do it anymore?
No, never. I think we, as attraction operators, as immersive entertainment producers, we will evolve along with our audience and we'll inherently know what it takes to bring pleasure from what we're creating. And we might get to a time where fear isn't as much of an attraction as other emotions. Right now, for me, it is the season of horror, but that changes, okay. Come Valentine's Day.
Ian Miller, owner and operator of the Slaughterhouse and Haunted Attraction in Des Moines. Thanks for stepping into our studio, Ian.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
And Dr. Daniel Trunell and Kelsey Spaulding of the University of Iowa. Thank you very much for sharing with us the science of fear.
Thanks, Ben. Great to be on. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Robbie Broad helped us out today as well. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.